Welcome to the CAMUD News. I'm your news director, April Lewis, and I'm glad to be with you for this broadcast. On this episode, we have in-depth coverage on recent earthquakes felt in Humboldt County and the Humboldt Sheriff's Department's use of license plate scanners for policing. But up next, a quick rundown of local headlines, including California's primary election. This is KMUD News. Starting off in southern Humboldt. KMUD News confirmed today, June 3rd, with Humboldt County Public Works that ongoing resurfacing roadworks in Redway and Garberville are finished. Drivers can rejoice and enjoy our local, relatively delay-free roads once again. Moving next to local education news. College of the Redwoods recently celebrated the inaugural graduating class of its North Coast Concurrent Enrollment Pathway, marking a major milestone for nursing education on the North Coast. Through a partnership between College of the Redwoods and Cal Poly Humboldt, the program operates as a concurrent enrollment program, providing nursing students with a streamlined and affordable path to earn both an associate degree in nursing and a Bachelor of Science in Nursing. Students complete associate degree coursework while simultaneously taking Bachelor of Science classes in a flexible, primarily online hybrid format. After graduating and passing the NCLEX-RN exam, students can complete their BSN in just one additional year, helping meet the growing demand for highly educated nurses across the North Coast region. Yesterday, June 2nd, in Eureka, on June 2nd, at approximately 1:20 p.m., the patrol commander with the Eureka Police Department had left the scene of an injury traffic collision at 6th and H Streets, where he observed a silver Mazda hatchback driving at a high rate of speed on the 1400 block of I Street. The Mazda made several unsafe lane changes and began traveling in the bicycle lane past vehicles for multiple blocks. The Mazda turned east on 7th Street and continued traveling at a high rate of speed while conducting unsafe lane changes. The commander and a patrol officer attempted to conduct a traffic stop. However, the driver was slow to yield and continued driving for several blocks before eventually stopping near the intersection of 5th and S Streets. The driver was identified as 41-year-old Lizel Norman of Eureka. Norman was taken into custody for reckless driving. And now, some updates on our California primary election. The following data is current to the evening of June 3rd. Election data is courtesy of the Associated Press. In the governor's primary race, a result has not been called. However, polling before the election appears to be coming true. With 54% of votes counted statewide, Republican Steve Hilton is in the lead with 27.8%, with Democrat Javier Becerra close behind at 25.4%. While still in the running, it is unlikely that Democrat Tom Steyer will make the top two to qualify for the general election. Currently, Steyer is at 19.6% of the vote. Barring a possible large change due to incoming ballots, it is likely Hilton and Becerra will be facing off come November. California runs a jungle primary system, where the top two candidates, regardless of party affiliation, advance to the general election in November. For other statewide offices, we have some primary election calls that have been made by the Associated Press. For Attorney General, Democrat Rob Bonta and Republican Michael E. Gates are confirmed as voters' top two choices. For Comptroller, Democrat Malia Cohen and Republican Herb Morgan will advance to the general election. For Secretary of State, Democrat Shirley Weber and Republican Don Wagner are the winners. Other statewide races that are too close to currently call include Superintendent of Public Instruction, Lieutenant Governor, and Insurance Commissioner. We'll update you on those races as more votes come in. For treasurer, Democrat Eleni Kounalakis is confirmed to make the general election, but the second place finisher is still undecided. For our local elections, incumbent District 2 Democratic Congressman Jared Huffman easily advanced, with over 50% of votes so far. It is unclear which GOP candidate he'll square off against in the general election. Democrat Damon Connolly trounced his competition in the District 2 State Senate race. With over 67% of votes so far, the second place finisher is too close to call. But Tief Gibbs is beating Aaron Smith by around 8% currently. Our most recent data from Humboldt County on the County Supervisor District 5 race puts Mary Burke squarely in the lead against Evan Schwartz, with around 75% of the vote going to Burke versus around 25% so far for Schwartz. And next, our in-depth stories. This is KMUD News. Humboldt County's use of license plate readers for policing drew heavy opposition when the Board of Supervisors opened the floor for discussion on it. Daniel Mintz reports.
The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office's use of license plate cameras is controversial, and the county will develop new policies governing their use. The use of automated license plate reader systems came under heavy public fire at the June 2nd Board of Supervisors meeting. The sheriff's office contracts with a company called Flock Safety for operation of 7 fixed cameras and 2 mobile ones that photograph license plates on public roadways. As discussed here by Supervisor Steve Madrone, who agendized the agenda item, the use of the cameras and its implications are of high public concern.
Today we're here because many Humboldt residents are deeply concerned about the continued use of Flock Safety cameras in our county. While we all want our sheriff's office to have the tools needed to solve crime, public trust requires real oversight, not just promises. The sheriff has assured us that new policies are in place to protect privacy and comply with Senate Bill 34. However, the county's own transparency portal tells a different story. Humboldt deputies continue to log nearly every search with vague one-word reasons like, in quotes, investigation or drug trafficking, while California Highway Patrol officers properly document a specific case or a call number for each query, which is required by Senate Bill 34. More troubling, all of this data lives on Flock's private servers, and the sheriff has no independent access to the full audit logs. That means when federal agencies access Humboldt data or when searches are conducted without proper justification, our office has no way of knowing. We cannot effectively enforce California law if the company controlling the cameras is also the one controlling the records. This is not about being anti-law enforcement. It is about making sure powerful surveillance technology is used lawfully, transparently, and with meaningful accountability to the public that pays for it.
But Sheriff Billy Hansel said the camera system is useful and furthers the goal of enhancing public safety.
So we do take this responsibility very, very seriously. We do take people's privacy very seriously. I don't want a surveillance state, but as we look around, we know that we are videotaped and we are tracked by a lot of different sources that are out there. But what we're using is technology to help solve crimes after the fact, and that we've had examples of solving or help solve missing persons cases. We've had examples of solving a homicide. And there's numerous examples of how we can utilize this technology when we have a hard time maintaining our deputies on the street and making sure that there's a patrol element on the street. And we owe our community the best investigative efforts we possibly can. And if that's incorporating technology, we are going to do it.
During a lengthy public comment period, only 2 speakers out of many supported the cameras. The many who opposed it doubted what Hansel was telling them. When one speaker said, quote, "I was really fascinated to learn today that we've developed a new type of camera that can only record license plates," there was a lot of laughter in agreement with the sarcasm. Others said the cameras, quote, "spy on the community they serve and are," quote, "a gross violation of privacy." Flock was described as, quote, "a Trojan horse coming in and acting like a safety company whose data storage can be hacked and accessed by, quote, rich people. Those who are less paranoid describe the cameras as a slippery slope toward loss of privacy.
I'm just a concerned community member, but there was one topic that gave me a bit of pause, and that was the designation of these cameras as being in an area where privacy could not be assumed. As someone who has grown up with phones in my house and has grown up being tracked by just about anything, you expect there to be cameras in every place that you walk into. You know that your IP address can track you at any moment. You know that your phone can be tracked no matter where you go. I feel that this definition of privacy has been shrinking over the past few years, and I worry that this is just another step in which our privacy will continue to shrink, and it will be another area in which we are tracked, and it will be a foothold for us to continue to lose our privacy in this state.
Supervisors had mixed opinions, with Madrone strongly opposed, Supervisor Rex Bone in support of the cameras, and Supervisor Michelle Bushnell acknowledging both their benefits and the concerns. A majority of supervisors voted to form a subcommittee to review the use of the cameras and bring back proposals for policies or an ordinance controlling them. Bone voted against that. Madrone's follow-up motion to take the $21,000 it costs the sheriff's office to maintain the cameras out of the annual budget failed to get a second. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Some Humboldt County residents felt two earthquakes early this morning, June 3rd. We spoke with Cal Poly Humboldt Professor Emeritus Lori Dangler to learn more. KMUD News reports. Lori Dangler is an Emeritus Professor of Geology at Cal Poly Humboldt. She's a longtime expert of the science of earthquakes and tsunamis. This morning, June 3rd, Humboldt County experienced two small but notable earthquakes that were felt by many residents, especially the second quake by residents of southern Humboldt. The quakes this morning involved a magnitude 5.7 earthquake at 3:53 a.m. north of Crescent City near the Oregon border, and a second magnitude 5.2 quake at approximately 5:53 a.m. 40 miles west of Petrolia. We spoke with Professor Lori Dangler to learn more about this morning's earthquakes.
Early this morning, some people felt an earthquake. Some people felt two earthquakes. And I didn't feel any, fortunately. I slept through everything. So what happened? We had an earthquake at 3:53 a.m. this morning that was located just offshore, well, fairly far offshore of the California-Oregon border. That earthquake was in what we call the Gorda Plate, the northern part of the Gorda Plate, and it was reported felt in Humboldt County, but primarily in southern Oregon. And then we had a magnitude 5.1 that occurred at 5:45 a.m. this morning that was on the Mendocino Fault, about 40 miles west of Petrolia. And that's a place where anyone who's lived here for a while should be very familiar with, because it was very close to the epicenter of the December 5th magnitude 7 Mendocino Fault earthquake that many of us felt. So these two earthquakes occurred relatively close together in time, but I would argue that they were not directly related. So the earthquake on the Mendocino Fault was not what I would call an aftershock of the one that happened far to the north. It was just coincidence that they both occurred at the same time. Now, both of these earthquakes, there's nothing unusual about them. So I just did a little exercise this morning of plotting earthquakes of magnitude 5 and larger in our area, and I came up with 99 since 1990. And they've occurred on the Mendocino Fault. They'd have occurred, a lot of them are in the vicinity of the Triple Junction near Cape Mendocino and Petrolia. But we've also had them scattered offshore throughout the Gorda Plate. And in fact, for the last year or so, there have been quite a few fairly large earthquakes in the magnitude 5 range, centered close to where that 5.7 was. Some of them have been further offshore, not really felt by very many. But we've had, well, the largest since 1990. In 1991, there was a magnitude 7 that was actually a little closer to shore. So no surprise about having an earthquake of that size in that location. Now, further south on the Mendocino Fault, the 5.1, I'd argue that that's still part of the December 5th, 2024 aftershock sequence. I mean, it's basically right at, I mean, practically on top of the epicenter of that earthquake, very near the western end of the rupture zone. And even though a year and a half may sound like a long time, for an earthquake of that size, it's really not all that unusual. So although aftershocks have basically quieted down, we've had kind of back to the normal range in that area. I'd argue for this still being part of that sequence.
We then asked Cal Poly Humboldt Emeritus Professor Lori Dangler more about how earthquakes trigger sensors in our area, especially related to tsunami risk.
Now, switching to tsunami, we have an additional, the earthquake recording network is actually the first line of awareness in the alerting process for tsunamis. We use the earthquake location and size. That's always going to be the very first piece of information we get. But then we have this network of deep ocean sensors. They're basically a little pressure package that sits on the deep ocean floor and very sensitive to the weight of the water above it. So a tsunami affects the entire water column from the seafloor all the way up to the surface. And even an inch fluctuation in that water column will produce enough of a pressure variation that it can sense it. Whereas a 20-foot, 30-foot wave that's just on the surface of the ocean, you won't see it at all because most of that water column is very quiet. There is a DART instrument off of the Oregon coast. There's one off of, I think it's Mendocino. We don't have any offshore of our coast at the moment, which I think is unfortunate. I'm hoping that they will put one in again because we have more earthquakes here. None of those instruments were triggered by these very tiny earthquakes. I mean, typically, you need an earthquake in the magnitude 7 range to produce a tsunami and to be seen, to produce any kind of signal that will be seen on the DART instruments. So for these events, DART didn't play a role at all.
Lastly, we wanted to know Lori Dangler's thoughts on how Humboldt County residents can best prepare for earthquake events.
Well, the good thing about most of the folks, I'd say who live in Humboldt County, northern Mendocino and so forth, especially if you've lived here for a while, we tend to be pretty self-reliant. And having stores of food, water, medicines, we need to be prepared. And we need to be aware of our hazards. And, of course, earthquakes and tsunamis are not the only one. We have wildfire, and we have floods, and Anyone who lives on the North Coast needs to become aware of how to be notified when it comes to great earthquakes. The most important thing is feeling the earthquake. That is your best warning that a tsunami may be on its way. We have, when the earthquake occurs on the other side of the Pacific, the tsunami warning system will disseminate information via radio, via text, and KMUD has been a great partner in the past, and I expect it will be in the future, for helping to interpret what's going on when the tsunami is coming to us from far away. But if we have a really great earthquake here, there won't be the time or the infrastructure to be able to get an alert to you. So knowing if you live in a tsunami zone and taking a look at the state maps, the Redwood Coast Tsunami Work Group, RCTWG, just put that into your browser, and you'll go straight to an area of links of the most current tsunami map, which is based on our worst-case credible event, which is a magnitude 9 earthquake in the Cascadia subduction zone. So preparedness is worth the time, and it also really gives you a bit of peace of mind. Is that I do have some control over my situation. I can make sure that if I am isolated for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, there are certainly some places in Humboldt which you might be isolated even longer, I can manage. Because in the big earthquake story, you're going to survive the earthquake, but you might be really uncomfortable in those hours and weeks afterwards if you haven't taken some efforts to prepare in advance.
You can find the website Professor Lori Dangler mentioned at rctwg.humboldt.edu. KMUD News is currently revamping our emergency response team, and we are going to make sure we bring you active, accurate, and up-to-date alerts on any disaster events impacting our region. Reporting for KMUD, I'm April Lewis. We move next to Rio Del, where the city is dealing with animal control issues post the removal of Miranda's Rescue as their shelter provider. We turn to a staff report which recommended an ad hoc committee to help with advising a future plan, followed by nominations of members to serve on the ad hoc committee.
Thank you, Mayor Garnes, and members of our council. So obviously there's been changes with the city's long-term animal care partnership, and staff believes that there have been and will continue to be significant evolving changes in animal care control in the city. So the intent of the creation of the ad hoc is to review past practices with the former service provider and potential future options in order to create a safer, more sustainable, and more transparent animal care and control system in Rio Del, one that lasts many years from today. The ad hoc will help advise staff as to what items should go before the full council for its consideration. And so the council can appoint up to 2 members of the city council for the ad hoc, or just 1. But if that's up to the council.
Motion to appoint Mayor Pro Tem Carter and Mayor Garnes as an ad hoc committee for animal care control. Then we have a motion and a second. Motion carries 5-0.
We'll keep tabs on the Rio Del City Council and future developments in the city regarding animal control, and of course, the ongoing situation with Miranda's Rescue. Next, we have a story from Suzanne Potter on healthcare advocates criticizing the California Assembly's budget proposal.
With California's budget negotiations down to the wire, health advocates are speaking out against the state assembly's proposals to roll back coverage for undocumented people. The assembly budget embraces many of the cuts proposed by Governor Gavin Newsom in May, who said it's just math given the massive federal cuts to Medicaid, many of which take effect in January. Rachel Lynn Gish with the nonprofit Health Access says we shouldn't roll back progress made toward universal coverage.
It's not just math. These are real people's lives, and people will lose health care coverage and get sicker, go into debt, and probably die sooner because they don't have access to health care.
State Assembly Speaker Robert Rivas said in a statement last month that the goal is to protect essential services despite the federal cuts. The Assembly proposes to put asylum seekers and refugees onto emergency Medi-Cal only, eliminate dental coverage for many immigrants by July 1st, and raise the monthly fee for undocumented people on full Medi-Cal from $30 to $50 a month. The plan would also reduce the asset limit to $2,000 for seniors and people with disabilities who qualify for Medi-Cal and Medicare. Lynn Gish says she hopes the Assembly and Governor will consider Senate proposals to raise revenue from corporations whose employees earn so little that they qualify for Medi-Cal.
We still think there is time to reverse course. We think there's time in these negotiations to adopt more of the Senate proposal. We call on the Assembly and the Governor to reject these cuts or delay these cuts.
The leaders of the State Assembly and State Senate will meet with the governor soon to hash out a final balanced budget, which must be approved by June 15th. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
That's all for our news broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our rotation of broadcast engineers, Dennis Marr, Katie Phillips, Biana Federico, Michael McCaskill, Larry Lashley, and Javier Rodriguez. Also thanks to our reporter for this broadcast, Daniel Mintz. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening. You can also follow us on social media at KMUD News, including Facebook and Instagram. Do you have issues important to you that deserve more attention? Are there stories we're missing? Or that you're curious about? You can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmod.org. Redwood Community Radio Incorporated is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located in the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to the region. I'm April Lewis. Stay tuned in.